We have a number of visitors. Let me try to bring you up to date as to what we're doing in the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon is a love story, the heroine of which is a Shulamite woman, a woman from the small town of Shulam, which is in almost plain of Esdraelon in the northern part of Palestine. This young lady had been in love and had been betrothed to a very simple local shepherd boy, a local peasant almost. And through some shenanigans of her brothers, who were trying to protect her in a way that was unhealthy, or through some inveigling in Solomon's part, she became involved or identified with the harem of Solomon. However, she had not had any relationships sexually with Solomon. And the story of this book is the story of Solomon trying to make a conquest with this Shulamite woman. The book is written in Hebrew poetic fashion, and hence is very difficult to interpret. It's very subjective. But you will find, at least we feel you'll find, that the interpretation that's given in the Amplified Bible is perhaps the best interpretation, because it sees Solomon not so much as the hero, but as the villain in the book. Now, while we're working through the book, we're trying to share with our people, and particularly with our teenagers and our young people, certain principles relative to male-female relations. And we have gotten to principle number 9. Now, I'd like to begin in the 2nd chapter and the 5th verse. I'm going to read there. I'm going to try to get through verse 7 and then give you the 9th principle before we go on with chapter 2. In the 2nd chapter, the Shulamite woman is reminiscing about her shepherd lover, and it actually makes her physically sick. She gets upset in her stomach. And so in the 5th verse, she has been recounting to the daughters of the harem, or the virgins of the harem, some of the events, or her first date with her shepherd lover. And she's upset, so she says in verse 5, "Sustain me with dried cakes, or dried raisin cakes. Refresh me with apples, for I am sick." Now, the King James here says sick of love. It probably means sick for love, or sick with love. She is absolutely physically upset with all these thoughts that she has for this young man that she loves. And she's separated from him. I remember in World War II so vividly the many physical separations between young people who had been engaged. And all of you, I guess, who have served in the military have anticipated some of this, how that when you're taken apart from somebody that you love, how very difficult it is physically for you. You actually get sick in the stomach. And this is the way this gal was thinking. So she says, she recalls the embrace of her shepherd lover. She says, "I can feel his left hand under my head, and his right hand embraces me." Now, apparently Solomon, at least the Amplified interprets, that Solomon is overhearing all of this, and that he sees that his advances to her are thwarted, at least for the moment. And so the Amplified interprets verse 7 as being spoken by Solomon. It hardly matters, because the principle is going to remain the same. I'd like to read verse 7 from the Amplified. They give an introductory note that reads this way: "Then Solomon, seeing the futility of further effort, at least for the present, turned his attention elsewhere. And the Shulamite woman, speaking to the women about her, who were shocked at her indifference to the things of Solomon, which they so much prized, said," I'm sorry, they interpreted it as the women saying, "I charge you," I'm sorry, Solomon says this, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles, or by the hinds of the field." Now, these would be wild animals who have total liberty over their actions. In other words, there is nobody forcing them into a pen or forcing them to do something they did not want to do. They totally live by their instincts and their reactions. And so the Amplified interprets this as Solomon requiring an oath from the daughters of Jerusalem, similar to the liberty that the gazelles and the deer of the field expressed, which King James, or Amplified inserts, which are free to follow their own instincts. That you not try to stir up or awaken my love until it pleases. Will you note the, if you're reading in the King James, that the Amplified interprets the subject of the verb please as it, not he. Okay? Now it could be either one, you see. It could either be it or he, or it could be she. Now there's a principle there. Regardless of who uttered the verse, regardless of the subjective side of that, there is a principle in number in this verse that we're going to share with you as principle number 9. These principles, in case you're a visitor, are relative to male-female relationships. They are divine viewpoint. They are biblical principles about the male-female relationship. Okay, principle number 9. Genuine love. Genuine love must be totally volitional. Must be totally volitional. Now by that we mean, one, it cannot be coerced. It cannot be forced. It cannot be forced. An example of an attempt at this would be a rape. I think that would be a radical example, but nevertheless, rape would fit the category. It's an effort of female-male relationships that is total coercion. Okay? This means it cannot be purchased. It cannot be bought. Cannot be bought. Now, infatuation can be purchased, or a relationship can even be purchased, but it is not a true love relationship and should not be identified as such. You know, if somebody hands you a big sparkler for your third finger left hand and you say, oh, I love you, and that's the first time you said it, if I were handing you the diamond, I wouldn't be put too much stock in it. Well, I wouldn't be handing you the diamond. I don't carry on that way, really. 3. It cannot be demanded. It cannot be demanded. If you are going with a young man or a young woman who has eyes for everybody that comes around, then mark it down that you know, your relationship with that person, if he or she is trying to express to you that that's a true love relationship, that's a lie. It's not true. Because they do not understand true love. They may be trying to purchase it. They may be trying to coerce it. Well, that isn't what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that if they have eyes for somebody else, you cannot force them to like you or to identify with you. And we often do this in a rage of jealousy. We'll try to get this for. We'll say, I don't want you to talk to any other men. I don't want you to talk to any other women. I'm so jealous about you. That means that relationship is very unhealthy, and this person is trying to coerce your volition in the matter. If you're a young man, don't try to stifle the volition of a woman if she is directing her attention to other men. That's her problem. And your problem is to evaluate that objectively. I know you won't believe this, but when I was a young man, that I've taken out girls, and they really didn't like me. They like somebody else better. And I had a certain attitude toward that. My attitude was, fine, so long, good. Glad I found this out. Goodbye. You can't force the volition of a woman. And don't try to do it. Don't try to buy it. Don't try to purchase her love for yourself. A woman loves a right man volitionally. And she has to have freedom to do that. Okay? I remember the town I grew up in, it was so bad that they decided finally there's nothing they could do with it, so they crumbled everything. The last time I was back here, there's a freeway goes through there now. It's a pathetic place. But I remember some of the tough guys I was gone for a year. I was down in Florida for a year working away from home when I was 17, and I came back and I start picking up with some girls that I knew before. And I remember taking one girl home one night, and she says, "I hope so-and-so doesn't find out about this. He'll kill me." And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "He'll beat me up physically if he knows that you just brought me home." I began to get a little wary myself. Now, that to me, that's utterly ridiculous, but that happened, see. Because of a misunderstanding of what love is and love identification. You can't, genuine love has to be totally volitional, see. A person's will has to be very actively involved in the expression of love. Now, that is what this statement is expressing, regardless of who says it, see. It's hard for me to really picture Solomon saying this. I kind of think the Shulamite woman says it. But it's possible that Solomon did. It's possible that Solomon would say, "Well, okay, don't try to stir her up until it pleases, until she wills to do the matter." Because in the end, he actually gives up. And it's very possible that he did say it. It's really hard for me to think he did. Okay? Okay, let's read on. We'll pick up at verse 8. Now the Amplified interprets verse 8 this way. Later one day, the vineyard girl was homesick and uncomfortable in this pretentious atmosphere that she was in. She grew reminiscent and said she could just imagine herself at home again. And she is envisioning an occurrence which is reoccurring with her. She vividly pictures this. And she probably does this orally. Okay, the verse reads this way in the Amplified. "The voice of my beloved," meaning her shepherd, "behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains. He comes bounding over the hills." Now, let's do a little exegesis here. In verse 8, here is the shepherd, and you want to get the word picture. Here are the hills that are separating them, and here comes this guy. He's running on top of the hills. Any resemblance to art is purely accidental. But he's really... And these hills, here is northern Palestine, and this Shulamite woman is in one of Solomon's apartments somewhere, probably about 50 miles north of Jerusalem. So here's Solomon's apartment. And these hills are separating the Shulamite woman from her lover. And she's envisioning this happen, and when she is envisioning this, she thinks of some other dates that she had with this fellow. I'll show you the proof of this in you want to compare verse 17. Compare verse 17. Now you'll never see this in the King James. The King James does not properly interpret verse 17. In verse 17 in King James, it says, "Until the day break and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart, a deer upon the mountains of Bethor." Now, Bethor, I wrote the meaning of that, and I don't see it exactly. Bethor. Here's our Hebrew word, Bether. Let me get the root meaning to that for you, please, if I can find it here. Where is it? Well, there it is. Bether means to cut or divide. And then it comes to mean that which separates, see? that which separates. Now that's what verse 17 is saying. Listen to verse 17 in the Amplified and see how much clearer it is. The Shunammite woman addresses her shepherd, her absent shepherd, and she says, "Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, return hastily, O my beloved. Be like a gazelle or a young male deer as you cover the mountains which separate us." See? Okay? Now, in verse 8, she anticipates that, see? And she's thinking of a time when he took her out on a date, and she's reminiscing. She says, "The voice of my beloved shepherd, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills." Verse 9, "My beloved is like a gazelle or a young deer. Behold, he stands behind the wall of our house." Now she's envisioning a date, see? Time that he came to see her. "He looks in through the windows. He glances through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, 'Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter, the time of the cold and when you're shut in is past, and the rain is over and gone, and flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth fruit and ripens her green figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth their fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away." It appears to me that she is envisioning a time when he had come to court her, to take her out. And they thoroughly enjoyed each other's company. And she's anticipating now in Solomon's apartment that he's going to come again to get her, see? And she's longing for that time when she can see him again. Okay? Let's pick up then another principle here. Principle number 10. Will you notice that he is the aggressor in this matter? In other words, he's the one who asked her out on a date. He's the one who came to court her, not vice versa. Now there's a very, very healthy relationship between these two young people pictured here. And I'd like to point out several general principles that are involved in the male-female relationship in this regard. Principle number 10. The male is sparked by the female. The male is sparked by the female. The idea in this passage is that nothing was going to keep this male away from this female. Now he was going to come to see her, and she is anticipating when he comes to get her out of this apartment she's now in. And she reflects back upon the time when he came to see her before. The male is sparked by the female. Now there's a reason for this, and that is by divine design. He is biologically designed by God to be the aggressor. Now, I'm sure you all know this. Not something new. Maybe not all of you. She the responder. Now, will you please note that this is partially a biological function and not simply an emotional function? It is biological that the male is made this way. And it is by divine design that God made you as a man to be an aggressor. Physiologically, male hormone glands are always producing. They are always secreting. Now, this makes a male more aggressive than a female in this regard. This also makes him more easily aroused sexually, stimulated faster than the woman. Female is much slower. Now, that is not an accident that a man is that way. That is the point that I want you to see, is that is by divine design. There are several sub-points that we could list under this. If you're a man, you should be assertive with a female. In other words, if you want a date from a girl in this church and you're a guy, the thing to do is ask her for a date. Not sort of hem-haw around, you know, and say, oh, do you like me? I like you. The thing to do for a man is to be assertive. Worst thing a woman can do is say no to you. And then you can look elsewhere. Don't wait for her to ask you out. Don't try to reverse the role that God has created by divine design. You be the aggressor in the matter. Now for you gals, in dating, you have to be careful about the signals that you send the guy. You know, we communicate a lot more with, the words are not the only way that we communicate. There are body signals. There are body expressions. There are eye expressions. There's all kinds of expressions. And you have to be careful about the kind of signals you send a young man. Because you start a biological process stirring that you might later regret. And whether the person's spiritual or anything, that doesn't have anything to do with it. It's physical, biological. I think there's another aspect of the male-female relationship that is related to this business of the biological design of the male and female. And that is that the girl will have to control how far sexually or how far physically she will go with a young man. That ultimately she will be the one to control that. The young man most likely will not be the one to control it. So the girl should not depend upon him to control it. I've had some very embarrassing experiences in this. Well, let's see how I'm saying this. When I went away from home and came back, I used to go to a dance every night. I'd drive to Cleveland from Pittsburgh to go to a dance. That's the thing we did when I was a young person, where I lived. We danced, I'm telling you. It's unbelievable. I couldn't believe it now. I remember going to this dance, and I danced with this girl. I went back to my best friend, and I started saying some things to her. Here they were secretly married, and I didn't even know it. And I'm telling him about her, about the signal she's giving me. They had gotten married because they had to get married. And I didn't know about it. Nobody knew about it. Now, you need to be careful about the signals that you give a guy. Because he is, by divine design, very easily stimulated because of the fact that his hormone glands are producing all the time. And this makes him the aggressor in the matter, and the woman the responder. Now, these two young people that we're reading about, we said last week, that they had that physical attraction was not the thing that held them together. That their soul attraction held them together. They had a physical attraction, no question about it. She's thinking about his arm under her head, how she appreciated that, his arm around her, physical contact they had. Okay, so point 11. Do we have these numbers right? Am I one ahead of you? Is this right? This is right, okay? Principle number 11. I changed the numbers on some of these, and I don't know if I should have. Physical attraction is often unrelated to soul attraction. Physical attraction can be totally biological. Can be totally biological. Particularly with the male. Now, it can be with the female if she is in love with love. In other words, she has been snowed by the movies and the television that in the United States, by all the ads and everything, that if you're not in love with somebody, you've missed it. And so a female can be in love with romanticism. And so she romanticizes every male she looks at, particularly if he looks at her. She'll think she's in love with him, particularly if he has any type of attractiveness to him. It can be a total physical attraction. But this is particularly true with the male. No soul relationship at all. When the Shulamite woman recalled the scene with her shepherd lover, her adrenaline glands begin to secrete. Her heart pounds. She is deeply identified with this man, but it's a soul attractiveness. Now that is critical. Because when there's a soul attractiveness, then there'll probably be a corresponding physical attractiveness between the two. But the soul attractiveness is the one that this couple had developed. And it is the most critical of the drives that bring a person together. So we have principle number 12 relative to this. And she's expressing these thoughts in her consciousness here, as she rehearses what had gone on the date. Where there is soul compatibility, where there is soul compatibility, there is generally physical compatibility. Now, I want to put in parentheses here because I want to emphasize this, but physical attraction can be totally devoid of soul compatibility. Especially with the male. Okay. Now, this is a principle that I really hope you get, particularly you young teenagers whose bodies are developing. There is many a young girl who feels that she's left out in the terms of the development of her bosom, and she becomes very anxious. This becomes a very serious thing with her. Excuse me if I'm very frank about this, but I think this is something that's very real. If you have a daughter that's a teenager, she's very concerned about this. And she's worried if she's normal this way. And she's worried if she'll attract a man physically. And let's say that she matures as much as she's going to mature, and she's a 32. Cup size A. Or they're small, I don't know. Let's say that happens. Now, you hear me seriously. I'm serious. When that girl finds soul compatibility with a man, and a man finds soul compatibility with her, he won't even be worried about that. He'll be pleased with that. I'll guarantee you that's true. That's by divine design. You thank God for what you have and what He's made you, and don't you let your physical, what you feel may be a physical impairment or non-development, don't let that bother you in terms of your self-image. God has somebody that for you, that when you find that person and you have soul compatibility, they won't be worried about that in the least. And they're not going to be making, comparative statistics with you. If they have any sense, they don't have these magazines around that messes with that kind of thing. They're not going to be making comparisons of you with somebody else. They'll be perfectly happy. They'll find their contentment with you if they have soul compatibility with you. You see? That's what's critical. That's what we should work upon. But we, in the United States, we emphasize the physical. Most of you teenagers are mature enough to know. Now listen, I'll give you a practical illustration. You know that you're attracted, if you're a man, a young man, to some physically robust young woman. You know that's true. Maybe you've even made designs on that person. But maybe you come to know that person a little bit and they disgust you as a person. But somebody in your class who may not be near as physically attractive and may have a nice personality, and you get to know them and you like that person, and you would much rather be with that person who is not near as physically attractive than you would with the physically attractive one. I'm sure that some of you teenagers have experienced that. That's because soul compatibility is much more meaningful than the physical attraction. Young people, sex, the sexual act, is only one aspect of human relations and of the marital relationship. It's just one. It's very important, but it's not near as important as it's made out to be in Western civilization. This young lady had great soul compatibility with her shepherd lover, and has protected her, as we've said. Okay? In verse 15, she says, "My heart was touched." The preceding verses were spoken, of course. It was a rehearsal in her mentality of what her shepherd lover had said to her. And she says, "My heart was touched, and I fervently sang to him my desire. Take us, the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards," meaning the vineyards of our love, "for our vineyards are in blossom," meaning the love relationship was very deep. Verse 16, "Quite naturally such enthusiasm for the shepherd had aroused the interest and the curiosity of the Shulamite here. But when they asked her where he was to be found, that they might see him, she said distinctly, 'My beloved is mine, and I am his. He pastures," kind of evasively, they feel she says this, "he pastures his flock among the lilies." Then longingly addressed her absent shepherd, she cried, "Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, return hastily, O my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young male deer as you cover the mountains which separate us." Okay. Now, I'd like to give you another principle. I just hope I'm not skipping any. I don't think I am. Principle number 12. Is that right? 13. 13? Okay. One of the great enemies of true love is infatuation. Okay? Being in love with love. Now, I'll say this for some of the media that we have today. When I was a teenager, the movies were horrible. Absolutely. They were so shallow and so fickle that the plots to them were just absolutely horrible. I feel there have been a few good movies, not very many. There aren't very good many anyhow. Somebody asked me if I saw the Ten Commandments in some of these movies, and I says, "No, I read the book. It's a lot better." That's usually the case. But there have been some more realistic movies made lately with very deep plots lots, that's not the word, a very deep concept of the relation, of love relationship between human beings. I thought the movie Love Story was very well done and a very accurate expression of human viewpoint on love, which you can't put it together, you know. The story ends with this young man tragically trying to interpret what had happened. He can't figure out what happened, that this sweet young thing that he had learned to love and she had taught him so much about love, that she died so suddenly and so quickly. And he doesn't understand that. He doesn't understand death. A beautiful expression of human viewpoint. Because human viewpoint cannot get these deep relationships together unless divine viewpoint takes over. This is what the Bible does for us. But we still have a lot of influence on in the United States on being in love with love, infatuation. It's a great enemy of true love. And this young gal was not in love with love. She was in love with a man whom her soul had identified with. Now, I mentioned before in this regard that there's a good test sometimes of love. We'll make that principle number 14. Physical and geographical separation. Physical and geographical separation is often a good test. Is often a good test of the right man, right woman relationship. Either your heart will grow fonder or it will begin to wander. Muhammad Ali and I sort of mess around with push. In other words, some of you are separated from people that you perhaps are a person that you love, you feel you love, in your college experience. That's a good test. Both for you and that individual. And if either one of you begin to wander, then it's time to throw up a question mark and see the red lights flashing. I had an interesting letter from a person who is now, I guess, not in their teens, in their 20s, I guess, now, that was in the last class that I taught Song Solomon to. That was in 1972. And this person was very much in love. And the romance has now cooled. And they have separated. A couple that had been going together with a couple for a few years. I was so happy to get this letter to see how this person was interpreting what had happened. And that letter was just full of divine viewpoint. And they were thanking me in the letter, this person was thanking me, for sharing certain truths about Romans 8:28 and other passages that helped them through that relationship when it broke. And they parted friends. They could see that they were not right man, right woman, even though they had been going together for a couple years. That's such an encouraging thing in the pastoral experience to have something like that happen. Geographical separation is often good. Here this young lady is geographically separated from a young man that she loves. And instead of her heart wandering, all she can think about is, I hope he comes and gets me out of this situation. I hope he comes fast, and I'm depending on him to do it. Okay? Okay, let's go on, chapter 3. Now in chapter 3, she chapter 2 ends with her trust that her, sort of an expression, that her shepherd lover is going to aggressively work out her rescue plan. She's going to depend upon him to do that. In chapter 3, she apparently has a dream. The King James says, "By night on my bed, I saw him whom my soul loveth." And apparently, she dreams of going out and looking after her shepherd lover. She's looking for him. And the next day, she rehearses that dream to the daughters of the harem. The Amplified interprets the passage that way. Read this way. "In the night I dreamed that I sought for the one whom I love." Amplified adds, "No wonder the faithful Shulamite dreamed at night of her peerless shepherd. It was quite in keeping with her policy to tell about it next day to the harem ladies. She said, 'I looked for him, but I could not find him. So I decided to go out into the city, unto the streets and the broadways, and to seek him whom my soul loved. I sought him, but I could not find him. The watchmen," verse 3, "who go about the city found me," met her, came upon her. That's an interesting word. That word watchman in 3:3. That word watchman. Notice it's plural. See that? Not a singular, but a plural. It's a plural in both the King James and the others, correct? It's the word shamarim. Shamarim. Now, shamarim means a guard, means a keeper. Here's the plural form. A keeper. I think this is interesting that this is in such an old book in the Bible. A watchman, or watchmen, we should put keepers here to keep this in the plural. This is what we'd call today policemen. Isn't it interesting? They had to have policemen back there. Of course they did. Where you have local crooks, you have to have a local police force. This is written about 950 B.C., and they had a police force then. They've always had a police force. And they always will have to have a police force. Why? Because there are crooks around. Well, it says here that the policeman or the watchman found me. The word found there is the word maya. Maya. And it means to meet or to come upon. To meet or to chance upon. So she's dreaming this dream, and she's out in this city looking for her shepherd. Now, it must have been a dream, because she would not have been looking for a shepherd in the city under a realistic condition. So she said, "The watchmen who go about the city found me, to whom I said, 'Do you see him whom my soul loves?'" Sounds like a dream, doesn't it? "I had gone by a little way past them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him. I would not let him go." Literally it says, I grasped thee. I will not let thee go. "Until I had brought him unto my mother's house." Now her mother is referred to in the book, and her brothers are referred to, but her father is not referred to. So most scholars assume that her father is dead. She said, "I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her who conceived me." Okay, let's stop right there. Now the idea was that she took him home in order to introduce him to her mother. Okay? So principle number, 14? To her mother. Okay? So principle number, 14? Principle number 14, is that right? 15, okay. Boy, are my numbers fouled up. You should introduce your date. You should introduce your date to your parents. You'll notice she took him home in this dream. And it may be a rehash of maybe her some occurrence in her life. You should introduce your date to your parents. And not be offended. And not be offended. by their desire. To know the person involved. Your parents are emotionally involved with you, and rightfully so. Now, I think some of the reasons that a teenager may be reluctant to do this is the idea that their parents don't trust them. That's not the issue at all. The issue is your parents are very much identified with you. And they want to know who you're going to be out with for X number of hours. This Shulamite woman and her shepherd lover are going to be misunderstood by her brothers. And her brothers are going to try to get her out of town because they misinterpret her relationship with the shepherd lover. Regardless how honorable and beautiful it was. Now that's the problem of the brother, not the problem of the Shulamite woman, you see. And her responsibility was to take her date home and introduce this person to her parents. We live in a climate that produces sort of an emotional polarization in these matters. There is an emotional revolt in our society among young people relative to the parents. But it's nothing new. The generation gap has existed in time immemorial. I never wanted to tell my parents the things that I was going to do that were wrong. I didn't want them to know. It's none of their business, I felt. There's an overemphasis of this, though. There's a publication of it. And we create kind of a psychological setting that polarizes us. I hope you don't have that kind of relationship with your parents when it comes to somebody that you date. That should not be the case. They should know who you're with. And they will want to know. So don't accept the date without introducing them to your parents. Don't be a pickup type at a ball game or a drugstore, some friend's house. And don't play the sneak game when it comes to dating someone. Take the person and introduce them to your parents. Be open and above board about it. Apparently this Shulamite woman had this kind of relationship with her shepherd lover. She had introduced them to her parents. In verse 5, she addresses the shepherd or the daughters of Jerusalem very much in this vein of liberty in this manner. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles, by the male deer of the field, that you stir up not nor awaken love until it pleases. Now the scene changes in the 6th and 7th verses. Apparently, Solomon now puts on one of his festive arrays for this gal. And a train approaches in which one of the vehicles of the train will be a vehicle prepared for the king and another vehicle prepared for the bride. Okay, so listen, verse 6. Presently, one of the occupants of the harem, glancing out the window, saw King Solomon's bridal car approaching. There's a word that's used that means a bridal car in verse 9. The car, doubtless, in which many of his consorts had been brought to the royal palace. And so these words are spoken. Who is, or what is this, that comes gliding out of the wilderness like stately pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh, frankincense, and all the fragrant powders of the merchant? In other words, it smelt like a Parisian house of ill repute. This huge train of vehicles with Solomon's consort. The answer comes in verse 7. Behold, this Amplified says it is a traveling litter. The King James says it is his bed. It's really not his bed. It is a portable bed, a bridal car. In other words, a bed for the bride. Okay? And it's all fixed up fancy. 60 mighty men are about it, of the mighty men of Israel. They all handle the swords, or they all hold swords. They are all experts in war. Every man has his sword upon his thigh, that fear be not excited in the night. King James blows the 8th verse. It reads this way at the end. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. It's not the idea. The idea that they'll put down any fear in the night, that fear would not be excited. Verse 9. Solomon hath made himself a car or a palanquin of state of the cedar wood of Lebanon. He made its posters of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple, the inside of it being lovingly and intricately wrought in needlework by the daughters of Jerusalem. In other words, Solomon has a portable couch, a literal chariot, a bridal litter, and he is approaching this apartment, and there's one woman that he has in mind who's the most beautiful in there, and that is the Shulamite woman. So in other words, he's trying to impress her. He's driving up in his new Mercedes, his new Jaguar, his new Cadillac, what is it, Seville, a small one, which costs more than the large one. He's got his Mach 1 rigged out. His Corvette is four on the floor, and he's got headers on it, and shaved heads, and chrome rocker box covers, and dual exhausts. I don't know what they have today. That's what they had when I was a kid. What's the name of a fancy motorcycle? He's got a Yamaha. That's not very fancy, huh? He's spinning the wheels, and he's just trying to impress this girl. Verse 11 reads, Go forth, O you daughters of Zion, and gaze upon King Solomon wearing the crown. Now that crown is a wedding coronet of gold or silver that is bestowed upon the male by his mother. And it signifies her approval for a marriage, see? Go forth, O you daughters of Zion. Gaze upon King Solomon wearing the crown, the wedding coronet, with which his mother Bathsheba crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. Okay? Principle 16 comes out of this. Solomon's trying to impress her. She is not going to be impressed, but he's trying. So principle 16 reads this way. A person is not worth having. A person is not worth having who is attracted to you. Who is attracted to you on the basis of glamorous things that you have. They're not worth their salt. Anyone that's attracted to you on that basis has not been attracted by your soul. There's another principle that we can give with this, and I'm going to give it in close. Principle number 17. If you are still Dean Martin divorcing his wife of 32 years and taking up with a 22-year-old. Now, come on. And the 22-year-old is madly in love with him. After all, it said so in that little gossip sheet that's in the rack in the meat market there. What's the name of it? Now, really. You know. Here's Charlie Chaplin. He's 82. One foot in the grave and another foot on a banana peel. And Some young thing is madly in love with him. It said so on the gossip sheet. If you are still overly impressed with the details of life, glamour, flair. Now, I'm not telling you not to have a little flair about yourself. You know, you don't have to wear white shirts, dark coat. I repudiate mediocrity. I don't believe in mediocrity. Socialism breeds mediocrity. You all wear dungarees and what do we call those olive drab in the military? Fatigues. Everybody wears fatigues. Even the women wear fatigues in a socialistic state. Good night. Yeah. Don't you get tired of that? I like some of the color they have out now. I like some of these Negro styles. Not for me. Negro people are never going to be successful until they start thinking more highly of themselves. And I like their independence. I don't believe in rebellion, and I don't believe in the violence. But the fact that they have a little style about themselves, that's okay with me. That's good. And color. Good. But if you're still overly impressed with that flair, high-minded materialism, you're not ready for marriage. I'll tell you that much. You are not ready for marriage. You know what? The Shulamite woman's shepherd lover didn't even have a 10-speed. When they went out on a date, they walked. You know, I know, because all the allusions in the book are to nature. She talks about the hills. She talks about the flowers, and she came to appreciate that because she was with him. Impressionists will do anything for a woman because an impressionist is malleable. He'll surrender his masculinity for a woman. He'll lose his individuality for a woman because he's an impressionist. And as fast as he gets one, he'll be flit off to another. Well, now chapter 3 ends on this sort of high note with Solomon waltzing in with his special train. And he has a bridal car all prepared, and he has great designs on the Shulamite woman. She's not the least bit interested, and in chapter 4, when we come back, I will see some more resistance that she puts up to Solomon. I will be gone for the next 3 Sunday nights. I hope you'll support Kenny Dahl as he takes over the pulpit in my absence. Shall we thank God for this time together? Father, we thank you for the opportunity to study your word. We thank you for this beautiful love story. We pray that you'll make the principles of this real and vital to not only our young people, but to all of us, that we may more fully understand and appreciate the divine design in the male-female relationship, and that we may fulfill our roles in this design as you please. In Jesus' name, amen.